This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to the main topic
in the margin of a book.
Kamala Samsee is the author of several novels and has been a finalist for the Orange Prize twice and the DSC Prize for South Asian Literature, and she's been named a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. Her latest book, Homefire, was recently longlisted for the 2017 Man Booker Prize. It's a contemporary retelling of the Sophocles play, Antigone. The book and the play were written roughly 2,500 years apart, yet the retelling is remarkably timely. I recently spoke with Samsee about her new novel, about political writing, and about language. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. Homefire is a contemporary retelling of the Sophocles play Antigone, and your book and the play were written some, you know, roughly 2,500 years apart, yet your retelling is so timely. Maybe we should just set it up. Homefire is told through a chorus of characters and from a variety of perspectives. And instead of the Thebes Civil War, Homefire is set primarily in London and focuses on the War on Terror. And the first character we meet is Isma as she's traveling to the United States to pursue her PhD in sociology. Talk to me a little bit about Isma.
Isma, for me, is in many ways the heart of the novel. She's still a young woman. She's just, you know, she's in her late 20s, but she's lived a life of huge responsibility. Her mother died when she was young, and she became the caretaker, really, the guardian and parent of her much younger twins when she was just 19 or 20. And the real story in the family's past is that her father, who she hardly ever met and really didn't know, was a jihadi, and he died on his way to Guantanamo, or at least this is the story she's always been told. There's never been any independent verification of that. But she basically suspended her life in order to be a parent to her younger siblings when her mother died. And now, finally, the younger siblings are going off. They've finished school. They're able to take care of themselves. And she's heading to America to do what she's really always wanted to do and what she was about to do when her mother died, which is embark in graduate studies in sociology.
And when she was in America, she met a man who was a familiar face to her, and he was the son of the Home Secretary. He was in the United States, and she met him in a coffee shop. And she didn't tell him at first that she knew who his father was, and I'm assuming it's because of her family background. But she had feelings for him, didn't she?
Well, you know, she's a woman who's had a pretty sheltered life in some ways, and again, hasn't really allowed herself relationships or really to be a woman, a young woman. You know, she's always been the sort of maternal, responsible figure. And then she meets this man who's just a couple of years younger than her, and he's physically attractive. But other than that, he's also someone who pays her a lot of attention, and he treats her as though she's someone who's really interesting, and he doesn't come on to her in any way. He's a man of exquisite manners, who knows how to, you know, talk to someone and treat them as though they're special. And for her, this is a fairly rare kind of occurrence, and she does quite quickly develop stronger feelings for him. But in the background is the fact that, you know, she knows who his father is, but she doesn't want to tell him who her father was, because their two stories are so diametrically opposite, although also entwined, because his father, like hers, was a Pakistani-British man, but one went into politics and one went in a very different direction.
And so the second perspective we get is Eamon, and it's after he's left the United States and he's gone back to London, and he very purposefully seeks out her younger sister to deliver a package of M&Ms or something. And it's because he saw the picture and thought she was so beautiful.
Well, there's a mixture of things. One is that he's seen a picture of this beautiful younger sister, but there's another element which has to do with his father. Because his father's family lived in the neighborhood where Isma and her sister grew up. And when Eamon was a young boy, he would go with his father to visit their family. It would just be once a year on the Muslim holiday of Eid, but it was part of his childhood. And at a certain point, for political reasons, his father guts off dies, or rather the rest of the family guts off Eamon's father. And he's severed from that part of his family history. And when he meets Isma, it's the first time that he sort of has a connection back into that world. And so there's a dual purpose in going to her neighborhood. One is to, you know, because there's the beautiful younger sister. But actually the more powerful pull at this point is he wants to revisit these scenes of his childhood where this hidden part of his father's life resides.
And then the third perspective is the twin brother. And how do you say his name? Parvez?
Parvez, yeah.
And, you know, up until this point, we know that the sisters are worried about him, but we don't exactly know where he has gone. And then in the chapters from his perspective, we learn that he has been recruited to join the Islamic State. And talk to me a little bit about what he goes through.
Well, without giving away too much of Parvez's story, what I will say is I was interested in the idea of him as a young man, and the man part is important as opposed to his sisters, a young man whose father, you know, is this figure he never knew, who dies far away from home and who had spent most of his life, rather than being a father, going and being a fighter in what he saw as various Muslim causes in different countries of the world. And Parvez grows up without a father, but with a very strong yearning for a father figure and with a really strong sense that perhaps he's not being enough of a man. He's grown up in this family, all of women, they're the stronger figures. So he's a very easy target for someone who knows how to come and press the right buttons. And someone does come along and very deliberately presses the right buttons and draws on this young man's sense that he's somehow failing his father and failing his father's memory, and that he has to get more actively involved in the kind of life that his father was living in order to be a good son. And so that is sort of Parvez's trajectory, which is very different from his two sisters, who are both at university and really have a strong sense that their father let them down. So there's no reason why they should feel they owe him anything.
And so then the next perspective is from Anika. And, you know, her chapters are written very differently. I mean, it could be poetry. Mm-hmm. It could be she was very headstrong and mm-hmm. very purposeful when it came to both, you know, her brother and to Eamon. And talk to me a little bit about her.
A friend of mine said about the novel that if you look at the two sisters, in some ways it's about two ways of being a woman. And Isma is the woman who decides she has to be responsible. She has to put her life on hold in order to fulfill familial obligations and, you know, is always sort of denying herself what she wants because she's either self-conscious or she thinks she doesn't deserve it or just doesn't know how to ask for the things she wants. And her sister Anika is the opposite. You know, Anika is very clear on what she wants and goes after it and is much more headstrong than her sister and much less likely to think about the consequences to everyone else of what she does. And the section which we come to her, at this point, you know, the plot has moved along far enough that we get into some fairly heightened emotions. But so that section is in many sort of shorter segments, some of which are within her consciousness. And others are how the world outside is responding to things that to her are very personal. So we have tweets, we have newspaper articles, we have news reports. And I wanted all of that to function almost like the Greek chorus did in the original, where you're getting the view of society, as it were, about these things that are also being experienced very intimately by Anika.
And that's funny. I mean, in my list of questions, I wanted to talk mm-hmm. about Eamon's dad. But the very next one says, you know, Sophocles' play featured the chorus, the group of elderly men, yeah. as a character. Did the tweets and hashtags serve as the chorus of sorts?
Well, I'm glad I pulled it off.
You did. You very much did. You know, the last perspective then is from, I don't know how to say his name at all.
Kermit.
Yeah. And he is... Oh, gosh. I don't even know. He's not very likable, in my opinion. I mean, he seems to have won his position and his status based on the fact that he was a Muslim, but then he turned his back on everything about being a Muslim and would talk to people about not wearing the garb. But he seemed to turn his back on his religion and on his people. Tell me your perspective of him.
Karabas is a pretty interesting character, I think. I mean, you see him from different points of view. So when you first hear about him, it's Isma talking about him. And her point of view is very clearly that, you know, in order to be a successful politician who is from a Muslim family in Britain in the 21st century, he makes a very conscious, self-serving decision to separate himself from Muslims and to sort of put himself forward as the Muslim who will talk about how other Muslims are backward and need to reform. That's her position on him. His position is different. He doesn't quite see himself in those ways and is fairly wounded that people from his community see him this way, and he thinks they turn their backs on him. So there are different ways around it, but at the center of it, of course, is the issue that to be a Muslim politician in Britain comes freighted with its own set of concerns. I mean, you know, within America, the worst thing people could think of to say about Barack Obama at some point was he's a Muslim, you know, as if this is a terrible burden for anyone to bear if they're going to assume public office, or a terrible role for them to be in. So Karamat is working within a similar world in some way, which is a world that is suspicious of Muslims, but he wants to become prime minister in this world and is making certain decisions along the way or having certain decisions foisted on him. So to me, he's quite an interesting character in that way, because he doesn't see himself entirely as self-seeking, but he's seen that way as others, and then he gets quite wounded by the whole thing.
You know, what a reader takes away from a book is very much informed by what they've read in the past, and what I focus on from Homefire will be completely different than the next reader. For example, just last week I finished George Orwell's essay titled Why I Write. And one of his four great motives for writing prose was political purpose. He explained that he wanted to make political writing into an art, and his books each started with some lie that he wanted to expose, some fact to which he wanted to draw attention, and his initial concern was getting a hearing. And Home Fire is very much about family and love and the definition of home, but it's also about immigration bans and jihadi warfare and racial profiling. And then I saw just last weekend in The Guardian, you were asked to reflect on the 70th anniversary of Indian partition. Do you consider yourself a political writer? Or maybe I should ask, what are your motives for writing prose?
Well, my motives are that I love the novel form and have since I can remember. I mean, the only thing I ever wanted to do was write. But, you know, when people ask me if I'm a political writer, my response, I suppose, is I see life and politics as completely entwined. And so if you're going to be a novelist writing about the world and people's lives, to me, it's not something separate. You know, it's not that politics is something you have to bring into it. It's already there for me. And quite possibly this has to do with growing up in Pakistan, where, you know, that distinction between lived lives and politics is just not a distinction anyone would believe in. So I am deeply interested in politics and how it affects human lives, but I wouldn't say that I set off wanting a hearing. It's more that there's something going on that I want to get to the bottom of, that is bothering me, that I want to explore more fully. And very often that thing is around politics. And so with Home Fire, I just became a British citizen in 2013 and started writing this book, I suppose, a couple of years after. So one of the things that as a new citizen of the state I was interested in is laws around, you know, citizenship and ideas of how different communities within a nation are treated, how they look at each other, how they look at themselves. So that was all, I suppose, in the back of my head. But because it's a novel, of course, it also has to be about those human intimate relationships.
You know, in Home Fire and in some of the pieces that you've written for The Guardian that I read, I was struck by your language choices. And for example, in one piece, you described Peter Hobbs' novel In the Orchard, The Swallows, as beautiful and true, adding parenthetically that true is a better word than authentic. And in the book, Lone hears his son say, "It's my truth," and becomes angry at the popularity of the expression, "my truth." And so I was struck by your use of true and then later in the book, truth. What does truth mean to you?
Well, what Keramet Lone gets annoyed with isn't the word truth. It's my truth. When his son said to him, "Well, this is my truth." And Keramet has a sense that we can't all have a subjective truth, and because it's mine, therefore it's true. You know, he believes that you should be able to talk about the truth rather than my truth. So that's the particular way that works. I suppose, you know, novelists are interested in getting at truth through fiction, which to some people may seem an odd way of doing things, but it's a way of saying that, that the truth is about what's at the heart of the matter. You know, it's not about the noise and the rhetoric and all of that. It is, you know, really when you come down to the essence of a thing, what is it?
You know, keeping on the language, in another piece in The Guardian, you wrote about the literary lineage of your family, and you said that most of your relatives wrote in Urdu, and you considered yourself an English language fiction writer. Yet in Home Fire, some situations were better described using Urdu words instead of English. In fact, one stopped me short, and I just stopped reading and marked it immediately. And you were describing a relationship that was closer than friend, and you used the word jigaridost, a friendship so deep it was lodged within you, could not be cut out without leaving a profound, perhaps fatal wound. And as an English language fiction writer, do you ever find the English language lacking? I mean, like the Greeks have how many different words for love, and we have one. Do you ever find yourself searching for a word that just isn't there?
Well, I suppose it's not so much that I see the English language as lacking, because, you know, it's a wonderful language with great variety and possibility. It's more that if you have more than one language, you're in the position of knowing certain words that are untranslatable, and every single language will have them, and they're quite telling about the language itself and how it's spoken. So there are times, of course, when a word in another language will seem, you know, particularly apt. But then the nice thing is that you can, you know, as I do, you can put it in the book. You can have some character put it in the book and then say, well, you know, this is what it is in English, but this is how I think of it. So jigaridost is one of those examples where you want to use the word and you think, oh, no, it's not in English. You think, well, I'll put it in my English book. And now it's in English.
That was Kamala Samsi, author of the book Home Fire, which was published by Riverhead Books. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new episodes at KMUW.org or on iTunes. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our editor is Luann Stevens. Our engineer is John Cyphers. And I am the producer. This is Marginalia. And for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.